Hello, this is Dr. Grande. Today I will analyze the case of Rob Reiner. First I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Robert Norman Reiner was born on March 6, 1947, in the Bronx, New York City. He went by the name Rob. He was raised in New Rochelle, which is just north of the Bronx, by his parents Carl and Estelle Reiner. Carl was an actor, director, and comedian, and Estelle was an actress and a singer. At some point, Rob's family moved to Beverly Hills, California. In 1964, he graduated from Beverly Hills High School. Not surprisingly, Rob entered show business. His first roles were very small. He appeared on shows like Batman, The Andy Griffith Show, Gomer Pyle, and Beverly Hillbillies. In 1968, he started writing for television when he worked on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Rob's big break came in 1971 when he started playing the character Michael Stivic on the sitcom All in the Family. The show was a tremendous success. It was the most watched television program for the first five of its eight seasons. In the 1980s, Rob changed the direction of his career and became a director. He would go on to direct a number of films, many of them through a production company he started called Castle Rock Entertainment. Among other movies, Rob Reiner directed the 1984 film, This Is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me in 1986, The Princess Bride in 1987, When Harry Met Sally in 1989, the 1990 movie Misery, A Few Good Men in 1992, The American President in 1995, and the 1996 film, Ghosts of Mississippi. He continued directing movies after this, but several of them were commercial flops. He was never able to recapture the glory of the 1980s and the 1990s. In addition to directing, Rob continued to act, but only in small roles. As far as his romantic life, Rob married the actress Penny Marshall in 1971. She was best known for playing Laverne DeFazio on the television sitcom Laverne and Shirley. The couple divorced in 1981. In 1989, Rob married a photographer named Michelle Singer. They went on to have three children, Jake, Nick, and Rami. In addition to being a well-known director, Rob Reiner became heavily involved in political activism and often shared his opinion that Donald Trump was terrible, dangerous, and immature. By 2025, Rob and Michelle lived in a $13.5 million mansion located at 255 South Chadbourne Avenue in the Brentwood neighborhood of Los Angeles, California. Rob continued to be active socially, politically, and professionally. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On Saturday, December 13, 2025, 78-year-old Rob Reiner, his 68-year-old wife Michelle, and his 32-year-old son Nick attended a party hosted by the talk show host Conan O'Brien. Guests at the party heard the Reiner family engaging in a very loud argument. Rob and Michelle left the party not long after this. It's not clear when Nick left. On the next day, Sunday, December 14, 2025, Rob had a massage appointment scheduled at his mansion. The masseuse arrived at 2 p.m., rang the doorbell and knocked several times, then left because no one answered. Rob's 28-year-old daughter, Rami, who lived just across the street, went to the mansion to investigate. She found Rob and Michelle dead and called 911 at 3:38 p.m. When the police arrived, they discovered that the married couple had been stabbed multiple times and their throats had been cut. There was no forced entry into the mansion. The obvious suspect in this murder case was Nick Reiner. At 9:50 p.m. that same day, he was arrested. At 5:04 a.m., now on Monday, December 15, 2025, he was booked on suspicion of murder. At the time I am making this video, Nick is being held on a $4 million bond. Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number one. Nick Reiner had a history of mental health and substance use problems. He first entered substance use rehab when he was 15 years old. By 2016, he had been in rehab 17 times and had several periods of homelessness. His parents, Rob and Michelle, repeatedly tried to help him overcome his substance use difficulties. Later, during an interview, the couple mentioned how they regretted the way they treated Nick during his addiction. Rob said, quote, "When Nick would tell us that it wasn't working for him, we wouldn't listen. We were desperate, and because the people had diplomas on their wall, we listened to them when we should have been listening to our son," unquote. Michelle also expressed concern about the wisdom of mental health clinicians, saying, quote, "We were so influenced by these people. They would tell us he's a liar, that he was trying to manipulate us, and we believed them," unquote. So Rob and Michelle thought the problem they were having as far as helping Nick was that the mental health clinicians were lying to them, not Nick. They believed the presumably licensed and qualified professionals were misleading them, whereas Nick, who was deeply trapped in addiction, was telling them exactly what they needed to do to help him. Rob and Michelle displayed a staggering level of gullibility. Item number two, Rob and his son Nick produced a movie titled Being Charlie. The film, which was released in 2016, was about a movie star running for Congress whose 19-year-old son was addicted to substances. The strained relationship between the father and the son was explored, along with the impact of addiction. At the end of the film, the father apologizes to the son for pressuring him into rehab. Not surprisingly, the screenplay was inspired by the real-life experiences of Rob and Nick. The pair promoted their film during an awkward interview. The interaction between father and son was detached and painful to watch. Rob seemed overly gracious and was desperately trying to please his son. He kept talking about how Nick was the expert in the film because he had lived through the substance use. Nick was distant, dismissive, flippant, disrespectful, and inattentive. During one moment in the interview, after Rob mentioned how he took Nick to a professional wrestling match one time, Nick said that his father never actually took him to that particular match, rather took him to other matches. It was almost like Nick was trying to embarrass Rob, making it seem like Rob was trying to take credit for a father-son experience that never happened. Nick claimed that he did not bond well with his father when he was younger, but working on the film made him feel closer to him. He also implied that a key motivation for him to remain free of substances was avoiding homelessness. He never wanted to be homeless again because it was too dangerous. Item number three, what do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. For the purposes of this section, I'm going to run under the assumption that Nick is guilty of murdering his parents, but it is important to remember that he maintains the presumption of innocence. The accusation against him has not been tested in court. Rob Reiner was given a tremendous advantage in life by being the son of the famous actor and director Carl Reiner. Rob never felt like he was particularly talented at any one job related to making movies. Rather, he performed well in a wide variety of areas. He said, quote, "I'm not that great at anything, but I'm real good at a lot of things. I'm a pretty good actor, a pretty good writer. I have pretty good music abilities, pretty good visual and color and costume sense. I'm not great at any of these things, but as a director, I have the opportunity to utilize all these things in one job," unquote. Rob's assessment of his abilities was correct. The best use of his talent was directing films. He had tremendous success in this area and established himself as a notable director. Rob took the amazing opportunity he was given by having a Hollywood legend as a father, and he made good on it. When Rob had his son Nick, he was about 46 years old. Having a generational gap this wide isn't unusual, especially in Hollywood, but it may have contributed to some difficulty with Rob monitoring or supervising Nick's behavior. In addition, Rob was a busy director. He might not have had a lot of time for his son. Even so, just like Rob, Nick was born with a tremendous advantage. He was the son of a legendary director. Instead of doing what Rob did and capitalizing on this opportunity, Nick went a different direction and turned to substance use. Initially, Rob and Michelle followed the advice of mental health clinicians who were trying to help Nick. The couple believed the clinicians when they said that Nick was manipulative and deceptive. The clinicians were almost certainly correct in this assessment. Substance users often use manipulation and deception to get their way. This is something that is well established in the research literature and well known to clinicians through their experience in the field. Many people who are addicted to substances will say anything to continue their use, including statements that are false. This doesn't necessarily mean they are bad people or anything. Rather, the deceptive behavior is considered a product of the disorder. Despite his parents investing in the correct treatment for Nick, he did not recover. Rob and Michelle were very unhappy with this outcome and misunderstood the cause. Nick failed to improve because he chose to continue using drugs. Yet his parents believe he failed because the clinicians gave them bad advice. Rob and Michelle believe the clinicians vilified Nick by calling him manipulative and deceptive, when everyone should have just listened to whatever he wanted. Nick was the expert. He was the one who held the key to breaking his addiction. Rob and Michelle were unable to accept the truth. What they didn't understand is that sometimes people who use substances don't recover. They will not get better until they decide on their own to stop using drugs. There is even a counseling treatment modality dedicated to this theory called motivational interviewing. A person can only recover when they are ready to recover, and Nick wasn't ready. Years later, when Nick finally stopped using substances, his parents continued to blame the clinicians. They never understood how addiction functions or what motivated their son Nick. They maintained the dangerous false belief that all the answers about his condition would come from him. All they needed to do was listen to Nick. They rejected the advice of the professionals and focused on that. The arrogance was observable during an interview when Rob said, "I know my child better than an expert does." Rob may have understood his child, but he did not understand addiction. Nick successfully manipulated his parents, even though they should have known better. When a person becomes wealthy and famous, like Rob Reiner, they tend to think they know everything. They tend to believe that they are better than other people, even if they never say that out loud. Rob was a nice guy in many ways and a great director, but he was far from perfect. One of his more substantial flaws was his belief that he knew better than the experts. He failed to recognize their education and training, but he also failed to recognize their objectivity. As Nick's father, Rob was inherently biased. He could not be objective. This left him woefully unprepared in the event of Nick having a relapse in the future. Sometime not long before the murder, Nick may have started using substances again. One of Rob's neighbors told the media that Rob was worried about Nick's deteriorating mental health. It's possible that Rob fell back into his typical pattern of believing that Nick would always present the solution to his own problem. Rob was not going to take a hard line. He was not going to push Nick into rehab like he did in the past. Rather, he was going to sit back and let Nick share his wisdom about recovery. Ultimately, Rob and Michelle were murdered, allegedly, by Nick. There is no way at this point to know why. Maybe his parents were about to kick him out of the guest house. Maybe he was using drugs. Maybe they were going to cut him off financially. Perhaps all three factors contributed to the tragic outcome. If Nick is guilty, then no matter what miscalculations Rob and Michelle may have made about his treatment, Nick alone bears the responsibility. There would have been no miscalculations if not for his behavior. Now moving to my final thoughts. I think the lesson learned in this case is the importance of maintaining boundaries. When parents are dealing with a child who has a substance use problem, it makes sense to have rules. It makes sense to believe the child is lying, to believe the child could be dangerous, to accept that the child needs to be accountable for their own behavior. And it makes sense to believe that mental health experts have insights into addiction that people not in the field may not have. Setting boundaries, demanding accountability, and seeking expertise are all acts of love, in addition to being acts of self-preservation. Sometimes survival requires the courage to say enough, even to someone you love dearly. It may sound inspirational to believe that everyone who has a substance use disorder just needs the world to follow their instructions. They hold the wisdom. They alone possess the key to smashing the powerful forces of addiction. This advice sounds so good because it's empowering. It gives all the power to the person with the addiction. The problem is it fails to appreciate the manipulation component. It fails to appreciate how desperately a substance user will embrace their own addiction, how they are really having a love affair with substances, and they will do anything to keep the romance alive. The real power they have is to accept treatment and to follow the rules, but they won't use that power until they are ready. Usually, this happens when the pain of using substances is greater than the pleasure. In the meantime, the individual may lash out and hurt people who stand in their way. Often, those people are the ones closest to them. Substance use is so pervasive, it finds a way to kill people who use, as well as those who love them. Those are my thoughts on the case of Rob Reiner. Thank you so much for watching. I'll talk to you soon. Rob Reiner is one of those polarizing figures, primarily because he became involved in political activism. About half the people in the United States love him, and about half, maybe not so much. Whenever somebody becomes a political activist, they're going to alienate one side or the other. Not surprisingly, as a member of the Hollywood elite, Rob Reiner was liberal. He did not like conservative values and, of course, did not like Donald Trump. Whatever his political beliefs, Rob Reiner was a talented director. He had a string of successes in the 1980s and in the 1990s. I think the reason his career went downhill after that wasn't about losing his talent or becoming a political activist. I think it was more based on this idea that he was making movies that he wanted to make, movies that he believed in. He was trying to make films that educated the public about various topics, like substance use. So the emphasis on financial success really wasn't there anymore. Rob was already phenomenally wealthy. He didn't need any more money. It just didn't matter to him. So he continued to be talented, and he continued to work right up until his death. He will certainly be remembered as a great director, someone who really did have a number of skills that he was able to bring together, just like he said. Rob was able to accurately assess his abilities as a director. On the issue of substance use and understanding Nick, Rob didn't perform as well, but this is really understandable. Again, many substance users tend to be manipulative, and they have a lot of leverage over people who love them. So his final lesson, I guess, to the world, Rob's final lesson, is really about being careful when dealing with a relative who uses substances. The story isn't about how Rob's a bad guy or how Rob made a mistake. The story is about how people like Nick can be very hazardous, and it's important to have firm boundaries.